Ready? Is the akhanda akara vritti a recurring vritti as depth of knowledge and clarity increases? The akhanda akara vritti just occurs when you're doing shravana, besides or meditation, also nididhyasana, also can be there. But especially during shravana, when the pramana is really being wielded and takes you step by step by step, and your mind just sees, like clicks into that recognition of yourself where there's no subject object, just yourself, where yourself is Ishwara, even without a sense of subject object. So you can't really know when those akhandakara vrittis are going to take place. They can take place just in a flash, just a moment of recognition, or it can be more substantial. It can be a savikalpa, you know, where your mind is still in place, but the content is just only really what the content of the teaching, even though there's a subject-object relationship, because the vritti is still available for perception. It's not an ati-sukshma vritti, like a highly subtle vritti. So I don't think there's any rules, really, about when that akhandakara vritti takes place or doesn't take place. But it doesn't need to be taking place all the time. Once you know yourself, you're always there. So you don't need an akhandakara vritti, because yourself is the content of the akhandakara vritti, right? And yet content is always there. And so in that case, and the world is mithya, if you understand what mithya really, really means, then this world is mithya, doesn't have any capacity to cover your own self-experience at all. You know, and so the content of the akhandakara vritti is ever-present. So you don't no longer dependent. But when you're gaining knowledge, then to have that clarity beyond any doubt that your being is not dependent on some sort of an upadhi, or doesn't require subject-object differentiation in order for it to be known, that it is self-shining, self-evident, all of these things. Akhandakara vritti can be helpful, but it's not absolutely necessary, because the nature of yourself is ever-present. So once the mithyatva is understood, and you recognize the presence of yourself, no matter what vrittis are taking place, then that's, in a sense, as good as an akhandakara vritti.
It's basically just a technical term to say that understanding is taking place.
Yes, but like the technical term, if we translate it, there's a vritti whose akara, whose form, is akhanda, free of subject-object differentiation. So akhanda means divided, the split. It's akhanda. Akhanda means there's no such division. So usually when we're talking about dvaita or division, it's the subject-object differentiation. Because if you remove the subject-object differentiation, right, there's no subject-object there, there's just the self-evident presence of my being. And so that's usually what's meant, is there's the recognition of just my being. Even if the mithya creation is there, it doesn't make any difference, because myself is free of subject-object differentiation, and that's something that's recognized. But the akhandakara vritti gives, in a way, an extra strength, so that because you have a recognition of just my own presence without the perception of the mithya upadis, you know, and so that can be satisfying. But it's also very important to recognize that that also is not necessary. Once the mithya, if you understand what the mithya is, that this mithya has no substance of its own, that has to be taught, the truth of that has to be recognized, and the recognition of the ever-changeless presence of yourself at all times, You know, that is what is necessary. Because say you have an akhandakara vritti, and then your knowledge isn't clear, and then you need another akhandakara vritti. Mm-hmm. It's so, okay, for me to really know myself, I have to have these samadhis all the time. That is not true at all. That's a sahaja samadhi, which is for a jnani, that's just the natural samadhi, which means the recognition of the changelessness of your own being in relationship to the mithya experiences that are there. So satya, mithya, these two things have to be really clear. And then you recognize myself as the satyam, as that which is real, that which is changeless, that which doesn't come and go. You know, you see your nature very clearly. And then the mithya is everything else, anything objectifiable. And what is objectifiable doesn't touch or change me in any way. And so in that way, and kind of understanding the analogy of the sun illumining rain clouds, you know, from the standpoint of somebody standing, you know, on the beach, looking up, all they see are the clouds, the dark clouds or the rain clouds. Okay? And so they will say, well, I know it's because of myself that I'm able to see these dark rain clouds, but when will I get to experience myself? That's the question. When can I experience myself? So that means, when that question is there, that this knowledge is yet to be understood. Because you are the one who's illumining the rain clouds. Right? You don't need the rain clouds, their presence or absence doesn't touch you in any way. You're the luminary because of which the rain clouds are known. So if you think you're the antakanana, say you think you're the mind, you have that, the ahankara is there, that the identification is with the mind. And then between yourself and the mind, there are these rain clouds. So that's like a cloudy, stormy mind. Like the mind has some emotional trauma going on, or some pain or something going on. And so now the one standing on the ocean is the ahankara identified with the consciousness that's there in the mind, you know, which is then experiencing the knownness of the rain clouds. But what it wants to be experiencing is the vritti. It's really just the vritti minus the rain clouds, right? And so the identification is only with the vritti. I want a vritti without rain clouds, not a vritti with rain clouds. That's the problem. That's the state of absolute state of ajnanam there. That's the self-ignorance. That's the whole problem. The ahankara has to recognize and become the aham, recognizing I am the sun that is illumining without any action on my part, just my very nature. I am the light, the consciousness that illumines the rain clouds. And the rain clouds are illumined by me. They don't touch me in any way or cover me in any way. Because of me, the rain clouds are known. And so I have to recognize the absolutely changeless, independent nature of my being, no matter what the vrittis are. I can have rain cloud vrittis or sukha vrittis or angry vrittis or whatever vrittis are possible in the planet, you know, whatever vrittis are possible. I am the luminary of those vrittis without myself being touched or covered by any of them. And so say to be a jivan mukta, to have moksha, it's moksha is not clearing out all the rain clouds. That is not what it is. It's recognizing that no matter what is going on in the universe, I am always the same. That myself, the Satchitatma that I am, never changes and is covered in any way. And these vrittis are there, these vrittis are there, whatever happens, whatever kind of vrittis are there. Yeah, that all belongs to Mithya, that all belongs to Ishvara. I don't need those vrittis to go away to be me. Then you can say, yeah, but why are you having those vrittis? My Swamiji says, the mind does all kinds of funny things, you know. So these vrittis are there. So you can't help what vrittis are there. You can respond to the vrittis in a particular way. you can respond to the vrittis as a jnani. You know, where whatever those vrittis are, whatever they are, let me be with them. Let me have some objectivity. You know, let me handle the situation internally or externally. That's some objectivity. Instead of being overwhelmed, the buddhi being overwhelmed by the vritti. You know. Also, as you gain knowledge, the mind settles down because it has solved the problem of sukha-dukkha. It's solved the problem of being dependent upon vrittis. No. Vrittis and dependent on vrittis, and the vrittis are dependent upon fulfilling my desires. You know, so if I, because I want sukha vrittis, not dukkha vrittis, and so we have to, you know, fulfill the desires so I can have a sukha vritti. That's all the samsara. So getting clear on all of this is really important. This whole thing about this analogy of the sun, you know, really highlights one of the major stumbling blocks in understanding Vedanta or gaining this vision. Because we have to say in so many ways that it's not about the vritti. It's not about the vritti. You're not going to get a infinite series of sukha vrittis. Not going to happen, you know. And it doesn't need to happen. Your self is always the same. The ananda of the self also is not a sukha vritti. You know, sukha vritti, like a happy vritti. It's not an ananda vritti. That's the ananda maya kosha, right? It's not a vritti. It is constant. It is never not there. It doesn't matter if it's a dukkha vritti or sukha vritti. Those are vrittis. We're talking about the luminary, the one who illumines the vrittis, the one who is the satchit, the conscious being, that those vrittis, mitya vrittis, depend upon. That never ever changes. You never change. So that is the big aha moment, I think, in gaining this knowledge. You know, that it's not about the vrittis. It's about the recognition of the one who illumines the vrittis and is never changes in any way. And then in Nididhyasana, as this becomes more and more clear, in Nididhyasana, it's just sitting with myself and recognizing, that's another aha moment, is recognizing that I am the beloved, and that does not equate to a sukha vritti. It equates to that there is nothing more dear than the nature of my own being. You know, that that which is the most beloved in the creation is the very adhishtana of the creation. There is nothing more dear, more beloved than that. But you have to recognize, oh, that's what, I'm just talking for myself. Oh, that's what that means. That's what that means. When I got that, it was a huge aha moment, you know, with that moment when I really recognized that there is nothing more dear than my own being. Understanding what they mean by ananda, you know, in reference to the self. That is the most beloved, that the what you protect more than anything else is your own being, because you think it's subject to death, so you protect it more than anything else. Why? What if it was dukkha? Would you protect it more than anything else? I don't think so. You protect and love, you know, ananda. So that which is the most ananda, the one that is the most beloved, is the one who is the most ananda. Then you have to, has the most ananda. Right? So you have, but you have to understand that, because it's different than the kind of a continuum of sukha vrittis. You know, happier, happier, happiest, most blissful, all that. Those are sukha vrittis. They come and go. You know, they're experiences of ananda that are dependent upon the quality of the vritti, the shanti of the depth of shanti of the vritti. So you're not a sukha vritti, but you like sukha vrittis because they resonate with your own swarupa, with your own nature. And you don't like dukkha vrittis because they don't resonate with you. It's like a, you know, what do you call it? Like some sort of germ or something, bacteria, and everything is going after to try to get rid of it. You know, something that doesn't belong there. That is not me. So that's really anatma. This is not. This has to go away. You don't say that about the super. Some of the super, it's got to go. You never feel that way. You just want to be with it. Even you have a sukhavitti, you even close your eyes and just enjoy the ananda. We have to recognize that the one who is the ananda, which then is manifest in the sukhavitti. And that's, there's a difference there, because the sukhavitti has different degrees of shanti. That's why you have all different kinds of classifications of sukha, all kinds of different words, because it all has to do with the level of shanti in the vritti.
Well, can I add something to that? The ati sukshma, the more like subtle vritti, how does that work compared to the akhandakara?
Well, the akhandakara vritti is going to be an ati sukshma. Ati means very, extremely. Extremely subtle vritti. Why they say that is because the vritti is still there, but there's no subject-object differentiation. And so what that means is, say just imagine like a vritti or a mirror or something, and that vritti has solely for its content the self, the nature of the one who's the luminary. Okay, that is its sole content. So now when the sole content is just the Atma, then the Atma is illumining a vritti that has no other content except the Atma. And so it's as though imperceptible, because the one that's illumining it is the very content of what is illumined. And so as if that vritti in Savikalpa, where the mind is kind of still aware of that, if it holds that for a moment, it will just automatically, not on by any will or anything, it automatically goes into Nirvikalpa. That's not something you can say, okay, time to go to Nirvikalpa. That just happens. That just happens kind of naturally. See what I mean? So what makes it ati sukshma is when the content of the vritti is the content of the subject. And so there's no dividing line. And yet the vritti is still there.
So there's never ever a time when there is no vrittis at all.
As long as you have this jiva upadi, no, there's no time. It's either it's when it's as though not there, is in deep sleep, when it goes into that unmanifest called avyakta condition, or in nirvikalpa samadhi. But in both states, it is still there. Yeah. And in both states, it's ati sukshma, but one is resolved into a jnanam, and the other is resolved into the subject, into consciousness. But the vritti is there, but there's no subject-object, distinguishable subject-object relationship.
So when they talk about like absorptions of samadhi, for example, that it's just going subtler and subtler and subtler, you can say.
Yeah, well, yeah, different levels of absorption, that's right. But nirvikalpa is the most. You can't go past the nirvikalpa. Mm. Because now there's no one to go past it.
Yeah.
Right? Because the subject-object differentiation is gone. Mm. Yeah, so that's the ati-sukshma vritti.
But you still call it a vritti.
Yeah. Yes, because you have a memory when you come out. Mm. And it's not like your prarabdha is over. So you go, you have a nirvikalpa samadhi, where there's akhanda akhara vritti. There's no subject-object anymore. There's just consciousness. That's the only experience. Because the vritti itself is totally the only content of the vritti is that of the subject. So the subject is illumining the subject, so there's no subject-object relationship then that's experienceable. But the vritti is still there, so the jiva comes back out, but it comes back out with the recognition of that. And the recognition is twofold. If we talk about savikalpa or nirvikalpa, it doesn't really matter. When one comes out of that condition, what you recognize is that the self that I am and I always have been, the me, this me, which is here right now, I recognize that I am free from time and space completely. free from I, that I am non-dual. I recognize that. That this me that is so well known to me as me is exactly as the Upanishads say. You know? Mm. It is free, absolutely non-dual. And now you come back from that and you recognize, you have recognized without any doubt that yourself is not dependent upon any other experience or any type of objectification, because the non-dual nature of yourself is self-evident at that time. So that's why it's very useful. It's very, very convincing. But these, the other relationship, the changelessness of your being with the mitya, has to be equally convincing. Right, because say you come back from that experience and then all you can say is, oh, I want to have that experience again. What you should be able to say is, ah, I really am non-dual. That's true. And the same self that you saw without the Maya Upadhi is the self that's here right now. So you have to remember that the self is not big or small. It doesn't, or it's not red or yellow. It doesn't have a size. It doesn't have a shape. It doesn't have a color. It is whole and complete, but non-dual. It's free from Maya. It's free from space. It's free from time. It's from free from, you're free from all of these objectifications that belong. You're free from the dream. You're free from the imagination. You know? And so now the thing is that say you're a character in your imagination, that character has to recognize that, yeah, here I am in this imagination and all of this subject-object is going on, all this stuff is going on, and at the same time I'm completely free. And now if you have the akhanda akara vritti, you recognize that, yeah, I'm still here without the dream. But you can have very, or without the imagination, but you can have very, very profound mini akhanda akara vrittis every time you wake up from a dream, if you have knowledge. If you don't have knowledge, you still have some kind of a, wow, that's amazing that dream was here and now it's gone and nothing has really happened. That's an amazing experience. But if you have knowledge, it's a very gratifying experience, because it's just like a drishtanta, an exemplar of the reality of the situation. Okay. What's the difference between eti sukshma and akhanda akara vritti? Please explain that further. That's probably clear now, right? Okay. If it's not, I'll go on. Are you clear? What is truly, I think, what is truly a sakshi? What does it mean to have a certain, shakti? What is shakti? What does it mean to have a certain power? Is shakti only a vritti? If yes, what's the point of having a certain power within mitya? Shakti just means, a power, a capacity. Like the three major shaktis they talk about. So jnana shakti, the power to have knowledge. Icha shakti, the shakti of desire. And then I think it's kriya shakti, I think the power to act, to do things in the world. So these are three major capacities. So shakti just means that power, capacity to do things, to think, to desire, to gain knowledge. We have these shaktis, these capacities. So, sarva shakti matvam, the one who has all shakti, is Ishwara. We're called alpa shakti matvam, the one we're ones who have a little, alpa means a little bit. We have a little bit of shakti. Ishwara has, like sarvagnitvam, he has the sattva shakti. All shakti is his shakti. But it just has, it just means power, but not like a power trip. Power like more like capacity or ability. you have the shakti, the ability to know, the ability to act, the ability to desire. You have these shaktis. Where Ishwara has the shakti to, for the whole creation to come into manifestation, to sustain it, to resolve it. So he has limitless shakti. All shakti is his shakti. Say like that. Yeah. Is it true that in Sevikalpa Samadhi there is still effort involved? I think once you get to Sevikalpa Samadhi, you've kind of accomplished everything that requires effort. And then from that point on, there's no effort required. Like you can't say, okay, now I'm in Sevikalpa, so now let's go move into Nirvikalpa. There's no will that can be involved there. It's a natural progression that if you once you get to the Sevikalpa, it will, if it continues, it'll be overwhelmed and will become Nirvikalpa. And so now to get to the Sevikalpa, you know, there's in the Yoga Sutras, which we also use, there's certain things like, well, just for instance, if we even start out with the asana, what happens when you have it, we're doing all of these asanas, really, in terms of the Yoga Sutras, the reason you're doing those asanas is so that your body has the strength and the agility, and you know, has stretched or whatever you call it, so that it can actually sit very comfortably in a very relaxed way for an hour in one position. And if you can do that, means that you can be very comfortable. Your body is so relaxed that you barely notice your body. You don't want your body, if you're meditating, you don't want your knees to call attention to themselves, because then the meditation slowly moves from yourself to your knees. Right? So you want to have an asana, to have a body with a good back, you know, so that the back can support you and the legs can rest, you know, gently, you know, on the floor or whatever. So that's very conducive to meditation, because the body doesn't call attention to itself. Then we have, you know, pranayama. So after the asana, there's pranayama. Pranayama really absorbs the mind tremendously and energizes the whole system in a very powerful way, actually. You know, so the mind is able to, the pranayama, if it is used for meditation, I mean, you can use pranayama in different ways, but say the pranayama is used for the practice of samadhi, okay, then you want it to be used in such a way that it really quietens and deeply absorbs the mind. Or we can also use it to truly charge up the body with prana. You can use it in that way too. I mean, there's a lot of different types of pranayama that will charge up the body, charge up the mind, you know, and then that has some health benefits, I guess, and things like that. But then you're going to have to wait for it to settle down, to calm down, which you can do. It takes 20 minutes or half an hour to really let it calm down. And then your mind has a certain shanti and can contemplate at a deeper level than without it, and much more quickly, you know. So pranayama, if it's understood and taught properly by somebody who knows what they're doing, which I don't, except breathe into the count of four, breathe out to the count. This is an easy one. I can teach that one. It's also powerful, though. Breathe into the count of four, hold to the count of four, exhale to the count of four, hold to the count of four. I call it the four square. These are very powerful, you know, but there's others that are also very, very good. And so using pranayama, then using pratyahara, which is learning how to hold your mind in one spot, you know, hold it at attention, which requires some training sometimes. Sometimes the person's mind has a really hard time doing that. So you can develop that. And then dadana, the ability to, the pratyahara means to pull in the sense organs, you know, to focus the sense organs more inwardly than outwardly. And then dadana, that ability to hold a single point and dhyanam to let the vrittis flow into that point. So these are all require practice, they require concentration, you're actually using your will, you're doing something there. Yeah. But when that matures, that dhyanam, that what we call this anuvritti of the same thought going like a stream into yourself, say the thought has for its content in your own being, then that will turn into samadhi, because where the content and the self are the same, you know, then there's a samadhi that takes place. It'll first be savikalpa, because your mind is still recognizable. There's still the subject object. The mind can say, oh, I'm in samadhi. It's still there to recognize what's happening. And then that it will naturally turn into the nirvikalpa by itself. So I would say that the samadhi is the culmination, the savikalpa samadhi is the culmination of dhyanam, you know. And then the culmination of savikalpa samadhi is nirvikalpa samadhi. So, like that. The Vedanta doesn't put a lot of emphasis on we're not working towards samadhi. You know, we're in the Yoga Sutras, we are working toward samadhi. That's exactly what we're working for, because if you say Sankhya Yoga, the Sankhya is dependent upon that samadhi and the ability to hold that samadhi. And the Yoga Sutras are a discipline, you know, Ashtanga Yoga, an eightfold discipline that can allow that to happen. To the point, it's not easy, but to the point where the prakriti bows down, and then that samadhi is just the natural state. The purusha is this just there, by itself, without any experience at all of the prakriti. It's just like a limitless, non-dual from its own perspective, because there are many purushas from the standpoint of the sankhya, but from its own standpoint, it's just non-dual consciousness. So from understanding that goal, the Sankhya goal, is really to have total vairagya toward the prakriti, so that there's nothing in the prakriti that is appealing to you to draw the mind out. And so even if you think like that, the asana is so developed that you don't have any, you just close your eyes, your body is so relaxed, you don't even have a perception of the body, it's so relaxed. And then turning the sense organs inward, away from the prakriti. Right? Say you practice that, turning the sense organs inward so that there is no experience of the prakriti. And then being able to hold that mind which is turned away from the prakriti, and keep it single pointed on something, which eventually, with practice, will be keep it single pointed on the purusha, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get that anuvritti, because you're holding with the dharana, you're holding your mind onto the prakriti. And then now that you've got it single pointed there, then that holding it, that anuvritti of the thought flow being held there is what we call dhyanam. That will mature into the savikalpa, which will mature into nirvikalpa, which is exactly the goal of Sankhya Yoga, which is why they want to use the potentially Yoga Sutras, you know, the Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, as their practice for the realization of the teaching that they are giving. That makes sense. Oh, please translate the words tadatmani nidate ye. It goes ye dharmaha mayi santu, the rest of it, right? So that means those dharmas Oh, I said there's more. I need that. I can't remember the whole. Oh, wait. Here we go. Tadatmani nirate ya upanishad. So the ya is ye. Ya upanishatsu dharmaste mai santu. So that says, dharmahate, those dharmas, ye, which are in the Upanishads, means Upanishadsu, so ye, which dharmas are there in the Upanishads, means which are taught in the Upanishads. So those dharmas which are taught in the Upanishads, mai santu, may they be in me. So far so good? May they be in me. And then it says, as the mai is in the locative, in me. Okay, locative singular. Tadatmani nirate. Nirate, these both, tadatmani and nirate, are both also in the locative singular, and they are adjectival to me. So may these dharmas, which are there in the Upanishads, the dharmas are the Viveka Vairagya, the Samadhi Shatka, the Sadhana Chaturshtya. So those dharmas, these dharmas, which are in the Upanishads, let them be, may they be, in me, who am someone who is nirate, nirata. Nirate is in the locative. In me, the one who is in love or revels in, who loves or revels in the Atma, which is Brahman. And so in the commentary, how we'll talk about that is the one who has that mumukshutvam, that jignyasa means that desire to know, but that desire to know is a very strong desire, because that is where my mind wants to be. So nirate, I want to be I'm always, just naturally, without much effort really, I'm actually always focused on that which is most dear to me. And so if what is most dear to me happens to be a glass of water because I'm thirsty, then I go there. If it happens to be listening to a beautiful piece of music, I go there. If it happens to be being with my child, I go there. Whatever is most dear at the time, even if it seems mundane, that is where I go. So now, here, what is most dear to me is this, the Atma Tad, which is Brahman, the Atma, which is Sarvam Brahmau Panishadam. That, the Brahman, everything is Brahman, the Brahman which is taught in the Upanishads, that's the meaning of Tat. And that Brahman, which is revealed in the Upanishads, that Brahman which is everything and is revealed in the Upanishads, that Brahman is the Self. Tad Atma, that Tad Brahma, Ahamasmi, I am that. So here it says, in me, may all of these dharmas be in me, who am totally in love with that knowledge which gives the Mahavakya that I am that Brahman. Tad, that, aham, I am that. So Tad Atmani, in that knowledge which is Tad Atmani, in the self that I am is Brahman. So that's the meaning there. So this ye and te, this is a relative correlative. So it's that which, so, or those which, it's in the plural. So the te would be those dharmas, ye would be which, right? So those which, so those dharmas, ye, which are in the Upanishads. Upanishads is in the locative. Ye Upanishadsu dharmaste. So te dharmaha, those dharmas, ye, which, Upanishadsu, are in the Upanishads, mayi santu, may they be in me. May I own those. May those be in me. In me, the one who is reveling, who loves, who is committed to the this knowledge, which is what? This, the Atma, which is Brahman. That this Atma is Tad, is that. I am that. When you say invoke the grace of Bhagawan, your guru, your Ishta Devata, what does that actually mean? Well, what it means for me when I use those words is when I say invoke the grace of Ishwara or Bhagawan. It's like a prayer where I bring Bhagawan, Ishwara, whatever Ishwara is to me in terms of any type of visualization or just my knowledge, I bring that to my mind. And so that now I am with Ishwara. So if I invoke the grace of Ishwara, I'm just really, what it is, invoking Ishwara itself is a grace. Just invoking Ishwara, thinking of Ishwara, being with Ishwara, is a grace. That itself is a blessing. So if you invoke the grace of Ishwara, means you're asking Bhagawan to be with you. So you recognize Bhagawan's presence as you're sitting here. You know, you're just sitting here with your, you think of Bhagawan. And then but you are with Bhagawan. That is the grace. Then, so, then also, if you invoke, then I say invoke your Ishta Devata. That also, there's something very beautiful about that. So if, when I think of that, the Ishta Devata has a form. It's the form of a devata. It's as though human form, you know, arms and legs, and, you know, that are subtle. But so when you invoke the form of the Ishta Devata, that is somebody that is the devata, somebody that you have some sort of emotional relationship with, in kind of as a form of Ishwara for me. It's a form of Ishwara, right? And so say if for me, if it's Jnaneshwari, you say it's my Ishta Devata, then if I invoke her form, how I do that, I could, there's different ways to do it. You could invoke her presence and have her seated with you, sitting there with you, and you're with her. And maybe you have little ones inside, you're with, the little ones are with her also, or you're all there together. Or when you invoke her form, or his form, whoever it may be, one thing that I love to do is just become her. Where this body, mind, sense organs takes on her form. This mind becomes her mind. Or a better way to say it, her mind becomes my mind. You know, her buddhi becomes my buddhi. Her dharmas become my dharmas. Which means that if you do that, if you would invoke her in that way, then the person who is then sitting here is really just Ishwara. You're in a form, but there's no jiva srishti there. It's just a manifestation of Ishwara in a form without any of the ajnanam, without any of the raga dvesha. There's just the objectivity, you know. So then, say if you imagine that form where there's no pettiness and there's no of these kind of ashuddhis, or there's no kind of these problems, it's all not also nice to be with the little ones in that form. Or sometimes you can have her separate and be with the little ones. And also, I think it's really a beautiful meditation, is because really you're invoking yourself just as Ishwara. You're using Jnaneshwari or Dakshinamurti, you know, to come in and be you. But really what is happening is you're just being with this upadhi as a form of Ishwara without any of the jiva srishti, without any of the ajnanam, without any of the raga dveshas and all of these things. And so say, for example, if you have someone who's very difficult for you, and the person causes you a lot of pain for whatever reasons, it's usually because you've got childhood stuff and somehow that person pokes into it in a way. So you've, because of that, and because this childhood issues have not really been healed enough, you know, that person's way of being or the way they treat you just pokes right into that pain, you know. So one thing that is very beautiful to do is if you, you're really evoking in a way your higher self, you're invoking yourself as Jnaneshwari, or as Dakshinamurti, or Ganesha, you know. So that can be Ganesha too. You know. But then, if you visualize the person, you know, who is so hard for you to maintain equipoise or objectivity in the presence of that person, you know. If you invoke yourself as Jnaneshwari, then you see how she handles that situation, or he handles, you know. And the tremendous freedom of that, because there's objectivity, that Jnaneshwari is not dependent on this person being like this or like that. They can be whatever they are. Nothing happens to me. And so sometimes by invoking that Ishtadevata, you becoming that, and you can see what it's like to be when you're really a jnani, you know, and the world doesn't have the capacity to kind of pull you out into this painful samsara. And so in that way, it's a very, I find it to be just a very beautiful meditation. Invoking your guru, if you have a guru, you have to have a guru to really know what that means, because there's so much gratitude. There's so much love there. There's a sampradaya of this flow of knowledge. And so when you invoke the presence, when you invoke your guru, the one who gave you knowledge, you're actually invoking that infinite and beginningless gratitude that goes all the way back to Dakshinamurti as the first teacher, or goes all the way back to Ishwara. Because every one of us all along the way of this teacher-student, as we gain this knowledge, we have an inexpressible gratitude. You can't even believe, like, what would it be like to not have this knowledge? And that's a really, it's impossible even to imagine it, what that condition would be like to not have it. Once you have it, you can't get rid of it. It's you can't remember what it is like not to have it. The only thing is you can teach it, but you can't actually recall the experience. It's not possible to do that. And so when you invoke that sampradaya, starting with your teacher, and there's all kinds of verses, beautiful verses about this, it takes that gratitude all the way back to Bhagavan, to Ishwara. And it also puts you in the line of that sampradaya, that beginningless sampradaya, that is so many beautiful verses. It's just the, you know, the flow of punya, blessing us, or the, you know, the dharma cloud, the cloud of dharma, just showering, you know, these blessings on us. And so in invoking your teacher, you're invoking the sampradaya, you're bowing to the Bhagavan. You're just prostrating to the sun for the flow of this knowledge, which is the flow teacher student teacher student teacher student, and will continue on through all of us. You know, that's the beauty of it. And so also that your guru also rests in your heart as somebody very, very, very important for you, you know, because they've done so much for you. Like, if I think of Swamiji, I think of so many things, you know, so many ways he helped me. It's just endless. Way even beyond this knowledge, way even beyond the knowledge, all the things he gave me, all the time he spent with me, all the questions he answered. You know, as I went on and on and on with my questions, he so patiently answered everything, you know, all of the different emotional problems I had. And I'd always tell Swamiji about it, and he would listen and answer things that made a difference. How much care, how much love. Amazing. So I always invoke his presence out of gratitude, because without him I wouldn't have this knowledge, you know, and I wouldn't have whatever degree of antakarana shuddhi I have. They wouldn't have that either. He took care of so many things. So I see that, you know, guru, Ishtadevata, Swamiji, and bringing that in, you kind of set yourself up for the kind of a sacred space when you're doing the meditation.
Can I So in those states of absorption, for example, I'm thinking about this perception, and is that an enhancement of the perception? I'm also thinking like, what is involved there in the perception? And also thinking like the third eye, like, is that also a perception? Or?
The third eye is really just called the jnana chakshu. It's not really a third eye. I mean, if you get into kind of the kundalini yoga and those type of things, maybe there's quite... we can do a meditation on... There are energy centers there where this, the different points for the chakra system. They are energy centers, and so they're really kind of useful to find that when you're looking from the standpoint of your body, to where to place your mind. Okay, you could place it in your hand if you wanted to, just by focusing there. You can find these energy centers. Now you just have to, like say if there's one here, jnana chakshu, the eye of knowledge. There's an energy center there, and all you have to do is move your mind around in there till it finds that, and then you stay there in the throat chakra. You find it, and then you use that as what we call the sternum, or the heart, where you place your mind for that meditation. That is an absorbing point if you're going to use the body trying to find the heart chakra. So they're powerful to do that. It's a nice meditation. What was the other rest of it?
I'm thinking more like in that state, but maybe like not even meditation. You can be like out. And that absorption state happens. Like, there seems to be, there's such a change of
Well, it's because there is a change, even perceptually there's a change because of the subtlety of the mind.
So it's the mind that gets more refined?
More subtle, and it can go back to being gross also.
Yeah.
but yeah, you can have more, much very subtle absorbed states of mind, and then everything's kind of shiny. You know, because there's no rajas or tamas really pervading the mind at that time. You know, the mind for a jiva has some contamination of rajas and tamas because of the body and the pranas. So say when the mind is just really, really very subtle, very quiet, then everything is shining bright. And in fact, the kind of the mityatva of the creation shines in that subtlety. It's because of the quietude of the mind. Is that it?
I had one more. It's just skipping. Yeah, I was also thinking about the like we're talking about today. That every sense organ has its scope.
Yeah.
I agree, but then there is exceptions, like synesthesia, for example. Is that like, is that new role?
Which one is that?
That's when you're, maybe you can see sound, or you can taste color, or...
Well, those are unusual states. And when I kind of, once when I must have been 18 or 19, we took some acid. I only did that a few times, so I'm still intact. But I saw sound, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. I saw sound, I saw music. It's very interesting. I heard color and all of those kind of things. So I think that somehow the mind can take on states. And you have to remember that in this, to just go back to our model, the Panchikarana, in this state of Virat has, in like space, has all of the four other elements there too. Each element has an eighth of the other four, 50% of itself, but an eighth of the other four. So I remembered when once I knew about this, I remembered back to that experience. I think it was 18 or maybe 19. And I never forgot that experience that I had. And then I remembered the Panchikata, and I thought, oh, maybe that's why I could see sound, you know. But for the most part, in our normal state, you
it
know.
Can happen also without psychedelic. It can happen.
Yeah, but there's
for
a
risk. Some people, there are.
There's instances of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my explanation of why, but that's not kind of the normal situation.
Yeah. When we talk about that, that's look like we're looking from. It seems like there's like a limitation, but if you. Maybe there can be new roads in the brain.
Maybe. But for the most part, when we're talking about the means of knowledge, I can just use these things as an example. As an example. That you can't hear color. Most people would agree with that, but then maybe there are some exceptions. So we'd have to take those exceptions into account, but for the most part, you don't. What the sense organ of your sense of hearing has to offer is different than what your sense of sight has to offer. They're not interchangeable. And I'd say, as far as I know, that's probably true, even for a person who has this ailment or this unusual capacity. I don't know if even they would say that they're, you know, like being ambidextrous, where I can write with my right hand and with my left hand. Some people are ambidextrous. I've never heard of a situation where I can use my ears to hear color as well as I can use my eyes to see color. Are they ambidextrous so that the ears can do the same thing that the eyes can do? Just asking. Look at. If they can, then we have to use that as an example. Except if you have this particular vibhuti. Something like that. Okay. Om Swasti Prajapyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Gobrahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Shobhavitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhad Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha.